Everybody ready?
Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
You're on.
You're on the air.
Are we ever going to start this frickin' show?
I just said you're on the air, numbnut, so talk already.
I always try to start the show big.
Show me what you got.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Oh, that's a big one.
And now, for the moment no one's been waiting for.
You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The High Ground. I'm Data Logan from Bremerton, Washington.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Go Cornhuskers! Hey, just go to Huskers.com and you'll figure out what that means. Okay, Huskers.com. We're playing right now as we record this, so I got the DVR working overtime. So, don't anybody give me the score. All right, Data. Data Logan from Bremerton, Washington?
Bremerton.
Okay. So what's the weather like today up there, over there?
Overcast. Might rain later in the day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
About 60.
Okay.
Fahrenheit.
All right. So why don't you tell what you've been up to lately? I can't pull the last show that you were up because I don't have Office installed yet, but what have you been up to since we last talked?
Work, family, some political activism.
You're the guy streaking down the streets in Washington for global warming.
No, not that kind of political activism. I mostly focus on election reform or, like in the United States, trying to overthrow the Citizens United ruling of the Supreme Court to get money out of politics, those kind of things.
Okay. Yeah. And once in a while I get drafted to work the election, so that's always fun. It's like 14 hours of sheer boredom sometimes.
So what do you mean by drafted?
Well, here, how do you get drafted?
I don't know about anywhere else in the States, but here in Nebraska, if the election commissioner sniffs you out and they find your name, they can legally force you to work the polls during an election. And you have to. They could do that up to like four times, and I've served my four, but I guess drafted now isn't the right word, but it was. But now I get letters saying, "Hey, you've been so wonderful in the past. Would you like to do it again?" Because I've done mine. So the only thing I have left that I could get drafted for is jury duty, and that's the one thing I would like to do. But yet, I don't think I'll ever get called for that.
Well. In Washington State, we don't have polls. All voting is done by mail. You never have to go anywhere. Wow. It's much more convenient that way.
Yeah.
And as for jury duty, I've been called to jury duty, but I no longer get to sit jury duty. Because whenever they ask you, I can get called, yes, but every time I go into jury duty now, and I think it's true in most of the United States, they ask you the question. Basically, they ask you, do you believe in the concept of jury nullification, or will you follow the judge's lead and vote according to what the law says? And I believe in the fundamental right of juries to vote their conscience, no matter what the law says. So I always get kicked off juries.
Mm.
But I think that was the whole reason for juries. Well, maybe not the whole reason, but the main reason for juries in the Constitution, the whole reason. I keep saying whole reason, but, you know, a big part of why we have juries is to allow everyday citizens to stop the tyranny of a bad government who's making bad laws.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Jury nullification, yeah, that's quite common. All you need to do is get one member of the jury to cry, and you pretty much have nullified what they were doing. And okay.
Well, this is not emotionalism, Lou. Well, I mean, there's some good reasons why a jury should not find somebody guilty, because the law is stupid, or the law overreached its, or it just doesn't really apply in this situation. Hmm. I mean, lawyers and politicians often want laws to be black and white, but reality is not black and white. And that should be the whole purpose of a jury.
Right.
But throughout so many states in this country now, they're trying to convince people that jury nullification is inappropriate. Plus the concept of strict liability. Like, some laws are written with strict liability, which I think is also inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway. Well, I guess, you ever watch Boston Legal?
Somewhat. Some in the past. Okay. Not much, really.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Boston Legal. I'm a bigger fan of The Practice, which started Boston Legal, but that's all right. All right, then. Why don't you go into the synopsis?
The synopsis for tonight's episode. Dr. Crusher is captured by terrorists who want to involve the Federation in their struggle for freedom. This is the 12th episode of Season 3 of TNG. It was written by Melinda Snodgrass and directed by Gabriel Beaumont. Guest stars include Kiri Keene as Alexana Davos, Richard Cox as Kirill Finn, co-stars Mark Buckland as waiter, Fred G. Smith as policeman, Christopher Piette as boy. What do we think about this episode? I like it quite a bit. I think it brings up a lot of good discussion points, which Star Trek is good at doing. I do think maybe it's a little too clean, but we can get into more of that later. What do you think?
Well, okay, I'll take it. I kind of like it, too. This is very deja vu-ish from last week, as we discussed last week as well. It's almost really the same episode, pretty much, except for the plot twist is the device for the plot is a little bit different. Other than that, I feel like we've done this before. What about you, James?
I think this is a tough one. I think this is, and I can see what they're trying to do here. I think that the episode is a little bit too simplistic in the narrative that it's trying to tell and the parallels it's trying to draw. I think if you look at it in terms of a Star Trek episode in isolation, I think it's perfectly well executed. It works well. There's proper dramatic tension and proper debate. But I think that when you project this over to I think the message it's trying to comment on, I think it's left slightly short, and I think it's a little bit just too simplistic in how they're trying to portray some of this. So I think that I don't think it's a million miles away from being a very good episode, but I think it kind of falls a little flat in my mind. And I think that I think it never helps whenever you have a difficult or an interesting discussion to be had to make it too black and white. And I think that this episode is guilty of that on a couple of occasions.
Okay, so we start the show with Crusher and Worf enjoying a pleasant meal at a restaurant, a seemingly nice planet. Except for the guys walking around with all the weapons and the funky headgear. But we're at Rutia 4. Again, we've discussed this last week. Why full Rutia 4 and not just Rutia? But we won't do that again. But there's a recent upsurge in violence in a group who really would like autonomy from their own homeland. And as they're getting the check and about to pay, all of a sudden a bomb blows up. And, of course, Dr. Crusher has to help. But the biggest question here is, They ask for the check. How are they planning to pay for that if they don't have money in the future?
I think some people have put across the proposition that whenever Starfleet officers have to go to a world where they have money, then Starfleet gives them an allotment of money. So there's that possibility.
Hold on, though. But is it in their money? So maybe it's a forgery, a fake money, or do they do something to get money from the planet so that they can use it on their planet?
They have a relationship with this planet. I would think they traded something for it, right? Mm-hmm. The Federation would go in, and they're bringing medical supplies, and they say, hey, we're going to give you most of this for free, but we want a little bit of your own money just so our guys can come visit.
I see.
Maybe.
So Dr. Crusher is guilty of selling medical supplies to this planet so that she
can... That makes it worse.
Yeah, so she can have dinner with Worf, and she's getting something on the side. I didn't think of it that way. Good bring up there, Data. James, go ahead and tell us why we're wrong, because we are, but...
it doesn't matter.
No.
in this case, it doesn't matter. I assume they get given currency.
We're here to talk about the minutiae of the episode. Yeah. I mean, if it doesn't matter, let's just go home. No.
I am home. I don't know where you are. I know James is home. I heard the little whippersnappers earlier.
Okay. Yes, no, indeed. I think that it's... I suspect that, you know, the reason why the reference the money got through is probably because they just forgot to take it out. To kind of, you know, sometimes they don't have any reference at all. Sometimes they do. It is what it is. But this isn't a Federation planet, and even if it was, you're going to have some way of there'll be some way, either formal or in it. There'll be either a formal agreement that you don't have to pay, or there are a formal mechanism under which you pay. It's relatively straightforward, whichever way you choose.
Yeah, the high representative of the planet gave her a platinum credit card and just said, use what you want, we'll pay for it. That's why there's champagne on the table. At least it looks like it. Okay, so anyway, the bomb has gone off. There's chaos everywhere. People are running around. Security staff are trying to cut off access. But when Data calls to the ship to tell what happened, do you think maybe Data may have held off on that report just a little bit too far?
So how have you been held off?
It took him too long after the explosion to report in.
Right. Yeah. It seems
that's probably true. I think it's just a Star Trek episodes often focus more on the emotion of the situation and less on the militaristic structure. So it's just one of those things, you know.
Right.
We were spending some time with Crusher, and it really would have made sense if Data had already contacted the ship before he walked over to Crusher and checked in on her. But,
Yeah.
It's a minor thing again. Yeah.
Well, here's an interesting touch. Normally when we do these shows, I have the episode up and I kind of shadow with my notes what's happening. And here's something I just noticed that I have never noticed ever before. As we know, the waiter of the restaurant has something to do with the explosion or has something to do with the bad guys in this episode. At this time, I'm having trouble remembering their name. Ansada?
The Ansada terrorists,
yes.
/ revolutionaries?
Yes. Whatever. As Data is approaching Crusher and Worf, you could see the waiter. Actually, he's handing what might be the check for another table, but he keeps looking over to where the bomb is, and I've never, never noticed that before. But it seems very obvious now.
I have noticed that. It seemed sort of I don't know. I thought
it's subtle the way he's doing.
Well, I don't know. I thought it was the opposite. I thought it was sort of obvious. Even the first time I watched that, it was like, oh, that guy probably has something to do with it, because they focused on him. And he was making an expression. He wasn't just a background character.
Right.
And he does turn out to have lines later in the episode. So it's, I don't know.
Okay.
And again, it's a trick of, you're on a television show. I mean, even in movies, it's the same thing. If you spend more than a second on a character early in the movie or episode, you know, you're like, well, the director wouldn't have done that if that character is not important.
No, correct.
It's like in real life, these kind of things could be happening all the time. And, but.
Yeah. And someone who's observant would pick up on it, which I wasn't until just right now. But here's an interesting thing. Worf and Beverly are sitting at the table. Looks like she's got food, but his plate is empty. So either he doesn't like the food or he scarfed it down in Klingon fashion.
Maybe he's protesting, I will not spend money here.
Oh, yeah, because it looks like her champagne glass is half empty or half full, however you figure. And his is pretty much where they probably would have filled it up to. Okay, so there's no other explosive devices in the area, and Picard says, it's time to beam them up. But yet, he stops. Because there's no way she's going anywhere, and Riker doesn't want to be in the transporter room to greet her. So, do you think Picard should have caved, or just beam them up anyway?
I think Picard made the right decision. But the whole scene, it really... a little off. It felt more like something that would happen with Dr. Pulaski and not necessarily Dr. Crusher, right?
Right.
Plus, the acting of the background actors down on the planet, the ones who were injured, maybe the makeup. I mean, obviously, this is mostly family-friendly television, so they can't get too graphic. But it seemed like everybody was not... Nobody was really hurt. Everybody's like moaning a little bit, maybe got a little bruise. And I'm like, there's nobody unconscious. Nobody has any deep lacerations. What does Crusher even need to stick around for?
Right.
But again, it's just the mechanics of trying to produce the television show that I think are a little off from what the writer intends. But...
Yeah, there was a little blood on the one of the faces, but he, like you say, there's not an arm laying over there or a leg over there, and that's typically what would happen in an explosion, but all it is looks like they just got hit with debris. Okay, so anyway.
And it's back to that. I think you guys often joke about how Crusher doesn't really ever save anybody.
Yeah, we have lately.
These guys don't really seem to need a lot of saving. And then later in the episode, when she actually does find people that are dying and need saving, she can't do anything. It's just she's useless as always. I actually like Crusher, but I also like joking about that. So I'm with you, Lou, I think.
Sort of. So, okay. Well, just as routine security shows up, on Sadist Separatist? Anyway, the supposed terrorist appears, grabs Crusher, and disappears after killing one of the security staff. Is this another example of Worf letting down his fellow crew member?
Now, I'm going to defend Worf here, because I know that, I think it's already been mentioned about, to what extent do you have to give up the formal military role that you're probably going to be taken in exchange for kind of drama. But I thought that Worf did quite well. I mean, he's okay. He gets up relatively quickly. He then starts calling out the fact there could be another bomb. He tries to get Crusher out there as early as he can. I think that's probably his responsibility. The fact that in the end, I think he then swept the area, right, for explosives, so he was kind of convinced himself that there wasn't a secondary threat. I think he's doing, frankly, what he can on this. And in my mind, it's clearly unfortunate, but I don't think it's really, it's not really Worf's fault that he loses Crusher this week.
As I say in Starfleet, risk is our business.
Yes. But, of course, we have four or five security staff from the planet. We have Data and Worf. But yet, Kiro Finn, I guess his name is, he was able to interdimensionalize himself about 10 feet away from Beverly. actually go up and approach her, shoot one of the security staff, and still get out in time before anybody even fires back.
Well, I think it's part of the technology, right, that the terrorists or the separatists have. Throughout the episode, they use it in an extremely focused way. So it's not as if they don't have control over where they're going to appear. They often appear kind of directly where they need to be. And although I think at the beginning of the episode, I think Worf calls out that perhaps they were going after Crusher specifically. I don't think we're necessarily buying that until later on in the episode when we find out that they have the dying and the wounded, or at least the ill, the dying and the ill at base camp. I always thought that Crusher happened to be the person standing in the way at wrong place, wrong time. But given what we later know, and given how well they can use their tech, I think it's perfectly reasonable that they appear directly in front of her and are well positioned to to execute what they need to do and to get out, because frankly, they seem to have all the advantage with their technology, and I don't think people are prepared for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think obviously when she says I'm a doctor, and the camera goes straight to the face of the waiter, obviously it looks like it's just scanning back and forth between people, but it was pretty obvious again that he had something to do with it, and he probably got a message: hey, you need to come here and grab the woman. Okay, so Dr. Crusher is now a hostage, and she's avoiding talking to Finn whatsoever. But I thought it was interesting that when he moves a little closer to her and he actually, I think it was a little bit later, but he puts his knee on the bed that she's on, that it freaks her out. But he eventually takes the shackles off her, gives her a little food, and then all of a sudden she opens up just like normal. Should she have even talked to him at all?
I think she did hold out. I mean, she didn't start talking to him at the first sign of food.
No.
It was at least two meals before she would even talk to him. Mm-hmm. But I'm of the opinion that when you're in these kind of situations, I mean, not that I've been in them a lot, although I did serve in the military in war zones, but I've never actually been held captive. But so I'm of the opinion that communicating is the way you get out of these situations. I mean, she could just wait to be rescued, but I think talking is the right thing to do. Get to know people. Maybe not talking to him right away is a form of communication. I'm not going to do what you want me to do, but I don't know. I'm of the opinion that, talk. Why not?
Then why do I have this funny feeling that anytime you're held captive, your name, rank, and that's all you give?
Well, that's true, but I mean, you don't want to give up operational details that would harm your own side, but you can ask. I think it's about asking questions. What do the opponents really want? Why do they have you? It's ultimately, and this is my big thing for the episode, ultimately, conflicts are resolved when we communicate, we learn what is the underlying difference of opinion, and we fix the underlying issue. I mean, that is much more frequently the way conflict is resolved. I mean, I suppose in some cases in history, conflict is resolved by just one side completely wiping out another side. Unfortunately, that does sometimes happen. But a much more productive way of resolving conflict is to talk or communicate in whatever method you have. Yeah.
All right. But Beverly does try. I mean, she says, I have a son. Who, by the way, we now have to explain why his mother was captured. And I couldn't help but think I really could have done without this scene with Wesley.
Really?
I don't know.
I think it was important. Again, the show should be about the emotions of the people involved, and certainly he's going to be emotional. It's also an interesting like twist on the first season episode, Justice, where he was held captive. Well, sort of. I mean, he had committed a crime and was being held captive by a police authority.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean...
That's true. They had to tell Beverly about it, too.
Right. So I think it makes sense. I think it's natural the way he reacts. He's like, I want to do whatever I can. Can I go down on the planet? And then Picard redirects his energy, which is good.
Yeah.
No, I have to say, but I agree with Data in the sense that I think the scene is good, that it directs Wesley's actions for the rest of the show. And, you know, it even gives him the ability to, you know, as part of the team, solve the problem at the end. That means they can get Crusher back. So I like it in that respect in terms of the guidance. I thought that Wesley was a little slow on the uptake in terms of, you know, when Picard was explaining it to him, but it was no more than like a couple of clumsy lines, if that.
Bargaining chip?
Yeah, that's what I'm mainly thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's my other little complaint about this episode. You know, I said it was like too clean. It's also like too much tell and not show, right? If you just had the scene where he finds out and he reacts emotionally and he's distraught and concerned and, you know, that would be good. But this, why do we have to add these lines in where we're actually explaining the situation? Why are we talking so much? And there's that scene later on the bridge with Data and Picard just talking, right? Instead of showing us stuff, they have the characters just talking about these issues.
Mm-hmm. I think that scene with Data and Picard, I think it's very bad. It's actually, in my mind, it's up there with, you know, Yar's turn to camera and don't do drugs. It's, you know, Data's turn to camera. And surely a terrorist is okay if he's has a just fight on his hand. And we don't need it. You really don't need it. And I think that, you know, the I think it's so kind of over-egged that I think it detracts from the rest of the story.
Really? I kind of thought the opposite in a sense because, you know, Data is making a very, very clear observation. You keep saying that terrorism is wrong, and I might even believe that terrorism is wrong, but gee, for some reason it seems to be pretty effective. So if these people want their own autonomy, if they have to resort to terrorists because the people they're up against, which is the government, they have plenty of weapons, they have ways to keep these people down, and it's kind of a degree of who's right. The government or the people who want to be on their own.
I think the points are very good and very important and very, very Star Trek-y. Mm-hmm. But it's just a little clunky that the only way to get those points across is to just talk about it on the bridge. And it helps that the character you use is Data. You know, he's the outsider. He's the one who does. And that is a trope, a very effective, well-used trope in Star Trek, where you have the outsider asking questions in order to allow the verbalization of these issues to not seem as clunky. It's a little clunky, but ultimately, it's some good stuff, and then that's the way they choose to present. It is presented throughout the rest of the... I mean, much... So down on the planet with Carol Finn and Dr. Crusher. I mean, you're actually seeing it come into effect, you know, Dr. Crusher really thinking about these things. And it's a much more internalized down there. She's not saying a lot of this stuff out loud, although she does a little bit when Picard shows up. But you can see it in her face. Like, she's truly conflicted about how she feels about things.
Right.
So...
Right, yeah, because she started, you know, didn't want to hear a thing he had to say until he brings her to all the sick and wounded, and then all of a sudden she kicks into medical gear, which a little guy brings to her. I thought that was a very interesting point that they actually used a child to bring her medical supplies. So I think what they wanted to do was humanize the terrorists by showing the children are a part of their group.
I think it also, and this is a part of the episode where they don't get too preachy about it, but it brings in the aspect of I don't know, terrorism or revolution or this any history of conflict between humans on this planet, right? It's often a generational thing, you know, like you were raised a certain way, or if there's a conflict between two groups, they're going to raise their children to also have the same conflict. And that kind of issue, like in order to talk about that or present it in the show, they had to have some children involved. And I think that was very, very well done because they don't talk about it as directly as they do some of the other aspects of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, what I took away from the idea of having the kids involved is, you know, it's not, hey, we're just like you, we have kids. I certainly took it more on the idea, and this kind of links into what happens right at the end of the episode, which is that, you know, we've been fighting for so long, or two sides were fighting for so long, that effectively you're raised in a norm, in a new normal that is, you know, you fight this person, and the kids come in very innocent, and the only thing they learn is that they have to, you know, carry on this war. And that's what I took away from it, kind of the inevitability of the continual, you know, the continual struggle rather than anything else.
Okay. All right, so now a little history about it. The Ansata bomb destroyed a shuttle bus containing 60 school children, which is why the... I want to call her the director of security, and it's interesting that they gave her a name on... Memory Alpha that no one ever says in the show. I don't know if you guys noticed that or not, but she'd never had a name.
Yeah, I think it's in the credits.
It is in the credits, but they never addressed her by
spoken.
Name. Yeah. So it's interesting that they actually give her a name in credit only, but anyway.
I wonder if there was a deleted scene.
Ah, good point.
Sometimes that happens, where her name was only spoken in a deleted scene or something.
That could be. All right, so anyway, the Ansadans claim that the bomb was a mistake and they were targeting a police transport as if that would make things just fine.
So again, that whole discussion between Riker and the police officer, this is where they're adding on the layers of complexity here, right? I mean, like initially maybe you think, well, the Ansada are terrorists. The police represent the legitimate government. But, I mean, listen to some of the things the police officer says. She says the insider are animals, right? She's dehumanizing them. She's not acknowledging the fact that they are sentient beings, right? And that's a common issue, right? You dehumanize your villains. She talks about, you know, they have, quote-unquote, excuses for their violence, as if they don't have legitimate grievances. And then, I don't know if you caught it, but she at one point mentions, I want to go home, right? This is not her home. She is a foreigner. And I don't know exactly, yeah, I mean, they don't get into a great bit of detail here, but the Ansada, they want to have their own sovereignty. They want their own independence. And it seems like at least part of the police force are not from here. They are, in some respects, maybe invaders. I mean, even though it's been a long time, obviously. We talked about, I don't know exactly when they were absorbed into the larger political entity, but then they tried to get independent 70 years ago. They felt they were separate enough, and then they were, quote-unquote, denied. Whoa, what does that mean? Did the greater political, I mean, it's one thing if the decision was made by everybody that we should not split off. But if you're being, quote unquote, denied independence, does that mean they didn't have a say in whether or not they were an independent state? Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it may initially seem like they're just terrorists, straightforward. But you get a lot of little hints in that little scene there that... there are some legitimate problems here.
I thought that their involvement was probably similar to our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, where a military goes in to uphold maybe that country's laws. And that's what she's probably saying by I want to return to my own home, you know, in another country because I ain't supposed to be here, but unfortunately my military has sent me here.
I think it's probably a good thing that the show did not go into too many details. Mm-hmm. That way you could see it a different way. You can create your backstory for this. You know, they give you enough details that you could overlay this story with different things. I mean, you could overlay this Ansada terrorist group with the American revolutionaries, George Washington, or you could overlay them with, you know, fundamentalist Islamic terrorism. I mean, you really could go different ways with it because they don't give you a lot of the specifics. So it's good from that respect. It brings up a lot of issues and maybe doesn't resolve any of them because you don't have enough details.
Could the Ansada terrorists we're going to call them terrorists because that's what they're called, but could the Ansada terrorists be, say, likened to Martin Luther King Jr. trying to get freedom for his people against a government that was oppressing those people? And like you said, this little story, you could bring up a lot of back stuff and think this is what it's about, this is what it's like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big benefit of this, or the whole point of this episode. And you, early on in this podcast, you said that this episode seemed stale, or like, yeah, yet another conflict between people. I don't know. I didn't feel that way when I watched it originally. Maybe now over time, because later on we'll have the Bajorans, who were terrorists fighting against the Cardassians, and we have a couple other examples throughout Star Trek. But unfortunately, maybe this story is repeated so many times throughout real life history and Star Trek history, you know. But there's every single conflict. There's two sides, and, you know, one side can dehumanize the other one.
Right. But you see, an interesting point, though, is you said earlier about what I brought up of it seems like last week's episode just retold in a different way. Last week, the Enterprise crew refused to get involved. This is not our... You said it yourself. This is not our fight. This has nothing to do with us. This week, it seems like the Enterprise is actually taken aside. And as far as a Bajoran conflict, that's an interesting point you bring up, because now I wonder, what if the Cardassians had applied to be members of the Federation before the Bajorans? Would we have been defending them instead of the Bajorans?
Well, it's never clear, unfortunately, in any Trek, but you got to believe that there's some standards for being a Federation member. I mean, we've done a couple different episodes, like with the Kesprit in Attached and other episodes where people wanted to join the Federation. The Gideon planet in Mark of Gideon, the original series. So there's standards for being in the Federation, and I don't think the Federation would ever consider allowing the Cardassians as they exist now, this time frame, you know, third season, next gen.
Yeah, I know.
Technically, they don't exist at all because they haven't been in an episode yet. But you know what I mean? Sure. Like, later on in novels, actually, the Federation and Cardassians are colleagues. Uh-huh. They're allies now. Mm. You know, Dominion War, post-Borg Blitzkrieg, which is something that happened in novels. But anyway... But this whole question in all the Space Nine series, especially in the first couple seasons, there was this question of, and even in fifth season of Next Gen, I think we're going to talk about it again when Ensign Ro comes aboard, you know, in this show. There is this question of why doesn't the Federation go and help the Bajorans who are being crushed under heel by the Cardassians? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't the Federation go help the last week's episode was The Hunted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah.
Well, they don't do that. And just like here, they don't step in and help the Ansada directly because these are outside cultures. You know, you have to choose your battles. And it's true in real life, too. I mean, maybe the U.S. is a bit of the police of the world, but we can't police everything.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't. We shouldn't. You have to choose your battles. There's plenty of bad political institutions or political institutions around the Star Trek universe / real world. You just don't have the power. You don't have the resources to do everything. So most of the time, I would challenge you. You said last week the Federation stayed out of it, right? And this week you're saying inside. That comes up in this episode where Carol Finn accuses them of taking a side. I don't think they are taking a side. I mean, Crusher says all we're doing is providing, food and medical supplies, and as soon we would give them to you too.
Yeah,
if you would ask.
Then ask. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah, so I don't think they're taking sides. I think they're trying very hard to stay neutral because...
But they assisted the Rutians to stop these people. And by the end of this episode, the terrorists, they're done. I mean, they shut off their way of transport. They helped the Rutians take over their forces. So, I mean, it seemed like we took a side on this one, where last week, because the Prime Minister pissed off Picard by saying, this is none of your business what we're doing here, Picard then threw it right back in his face. Hey, this is none of my business what we're doing here.
Yeah, I see. And I'm going to have to blame Riker for this. Riker makes some bad calls in this episode. We're totally off track now. But anyway, there's that scene where the police officer is interrogating people. And then he seems a little upset. And she specifically asks him, do you think I should do something differently? And he says, no, just keep doing what you're doing. The very next terrorist comes in, or possible terrorist, right? It's the waiter. Same guy. Mm-hmm. And she starts interrogating him, just like she's presumably been doing for a lot of different people. And then Riker just butts in and tells the terrorist, the possible terrorist, to take a message, right? She was trying to coordinate with you, and you just butted in. Bad decision, bad call. Mm-hmm. But then, okay, so then later on, Picard gets captured. So Riker is in charge of the mission. And you're probably right. It was a bad call to go rescue Picard and Crusher with the local constabulary. They should have just done it themselves using Starfleet personnel and not just turned over the location of the Ansada compound. Right? Yeah. I mean, you're probably right. That was a bad call because that is choosing stuff
right.
A little too much.
Right. All right, Doc, you keep saying in the last few episodes that you talk way too much, and certainly in the last 10 minutes we've shut you out. So why don't you go ahead and come back in?
Yeah, sure. Actually, there are a couple of things I think I kind of should point out. I don't think there is a huge amount of evidence put on the screen as to what why these people kind of do want to break away and whether or not they are being mistreated by the rest of the planet. I know that there was a reference before about how the police force are trying to dehumanize them, but I think frankly that takes place, whatever the individual is, whether it's a terrorist or whether it's a drug smuggler or frankly, I'm sure the people at the IRS probably think the same thing about tax cheats. Mm. It's just a way to get through your day. So I don't actually necessarily take away that there's a huge, population that are being suppressed. And they do leave that rather vague. Because I think if there is a population that's being suppressed or being mistreated, then in my mind, something that comes up is that I think the Federation does have a responsibility to do business with people that it feels morally comfortable to be doing business with. So I think when a thing gets thrown back at them about, well, you're giving medical supplies to this regime, if this regime is indeed, despicable and keeping people under pretty tight, pretty bad controls, then that I think the Federation has a lot of questions to answer. But if it's not, then, you know, I think that there becomes less questions. It's more morally okay for us to be dealing with, quote unquote, the one side, because the people on the opposite, you know, the terrorists, they potentially don't have a, you know, don't have a huge grievance. Another thing that I would kind of throw out, and I mean, I need to be, I'm going to be trying to be careful so I don't offend anyone with a lot of this, because it's, at some point I'm probably going to just misspeak. But so this episode was banned in the UK for a very long time, and it was banned in the UK because of, you know, there is the reference to the United Ireland, but there are also other things going on. I think you can fairly easily see anecdotal evidence, at least, that what they're trying to portray here is a thinly veiled, you know, Northern Ireland situation. Now, for people that aren't aware, you know, there was a union between, you know, Great Britain and Ireland. So the entirety of what is now the Republic of Ireland was part of the same country that the UK belongs to. And around, I think, 100 years ago or so, effectively, Ireland broke off, or at least that's when it kind of, you know, that's when it all started. Now, this episode airs, I think, about 70 years after the kind of the first, I think it was the first, either it was a referendum or an election that took place in Ireland that really started the breakup of the United Kingdom. And I think that ties in pretty much exactly with the figures that quote in terms of how long this struggle has been going on for, at least the quote about these people were not allowed to be given their freedom 70 years ago. So this is almost exactly the same kind of timescale you're looking at. So I think that it was very much taken as a kind of as a commentary on the Irish situation. Now, by the way, for anyone that doesn't know, what happened in Ireland is that, you know, I'm going to say half, but it's not half. It's more like, you know, three quarters of the country broke off. They are their own sovereign state. And to this day, Northern Ireland, or the northern, you know, the counties of Ireland, remain as part of the United Kingdom. And throughout the, you know, throughout the 20th century, and we had problems with terrorism from Ireland. And what we're generally talking about here is, you know, it's not... It is, you know, targeting. It was targeting of police, and, you know, and what one might describe as a more legitimate target, but then also in terms of, you know, indiscriminate targeting of civilians. Now, in my mind, I think that those, you know, potentially, if you're talking about like the subtleties of freedom fighters versus civilian versus terrorists, I think there is a difference between going after, you know, your local. In the same way that, in the way that Kiera went over the local, you know, Kardashians on Bajor, I think that's different than actually going into the more general population and putting bombs in cafes and the like. And I think that's not really addressed in this episode. I think that there's just, you know, just as a viewpoint from the UK, I think this was really much seen as very much as a kind of as a relatively simplistic commentary on the Irish situation, and I think that's really one of the you know, one of the things that would resonate more with a UK viewer than perhaps it does in the US. And by the way, I'd be interested in knowing now how you guys feel this episode would be received now that we're kind of in a post 9/11 world. Because I think in my mind, a lot of the naivety around how the terrorism is portrayed, and I mean, in particular, I'm talking about there's not a lot of discussion between, you know, what's a legitimate target and what's not. Not a huge amount of discussion around whether these people do have a grievance or not. I wonder how that would be perceived now, post 9/11, because I think, perhaps I'm being unfair, but I think that there was a bit of a kind of romanticized view of certainly the Irish situation in the US, and I think that's where I think a lot of the cleanness in this particular episode comes from.
I don't see any parallels to 9/11, to be honest with you. I mean, these terrorists, they're fighting for what they believe to be a proper goal. They want their own independence and freedom. That's not the same thing what happened 9/11. That was just hatred of all Americans, and we just wanted to cripple them. And you got to admit, for 4 days, that's pretty much what it did, was cripple us.
Oh, I think there are, I mean, I think we can get into many parallels.
Yeah.
I think it depends. You know, it depends how you want to ever slice an issue. But I don't think it would. I don't think it would take much for someone to be able to construct an argument whereby. I mean, it would probably suit better to consider the U.S. as the same as the Enterprise in this situation, effectively kind of, you know, siding with one party or another. But I think it wouldn't take a huge amount for you to claim that the U.S. and, you know, the policy that U.S. has with Israel makes them a legitimate target for, you know, for Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not what necessarily happened on 9/11, but I think you could very easily make that kind of argument, certainly.
How about the George Washington argument that Finn had?
I thought that the George Washington argument was not particularly valid, because when I don't know what he was trying to say about, you know, what was it really, what he was, what was he trying to see in terms of a parallel? If the parallel is that, you know, this guy's fighting for his country, then lots of people fight for their country, and you wouldn't want to bring up that, you know, me, like Hitler, we're fighting for our country. So I don't see why, because you share that with George Washington, it's a good thing. But if you share it with a less desirable figure, it's somehow something you know, don't mention.
I don't think it had a parallel with George Washington. The only thing he was trying to say was to counter her argument of, you're just a terrorist. And he's saying, you know, he's no different than George Washington. George Washington was successful, so he's called a general. But if you're not, you're called a terrorist.
I think history has shown. Go ahead, James.
No, sorry. The one thing I'd throw out, and what I mentioned, is that I think legitimacy of target is one thing you could throw up as being, you know, the number one. You know, let's just for a second assume that. Who you target as part of any kind of armed conflict, would that not be a decent discriminator as to whether or not you would be want to be considered a freedom fighter or whether or not you want to be considered a terrorist?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's all a question about the rules of war, and your actions have to be proportional and, what's the other term? Proportional and I'm not sure exactly, but I learned it once in some schools when I was in the Navy as an officer. We had to take courses in the rules of war, right? And the whenever we went into certain situations, when we were deployed to certain war zones, we were told, you know, here's the standing threat level, here's the rules of war you're allowed to use, and at all times. No matter what's going on, even in peaceful situations, you are allowed to defend yourself and kill somebody. You know, that's true even if you're not in the military. But how aggressive you are should be proportional to the threat. And we're not given a lot of information in the episode about exactly how aggressive these inside separatists are. You know, Crusher says that they're killing innocent people, but maybe it's an accidental thing, right? That, like, when they blew up the school bus, they said, the Ansada said that it was an accident, that they were trying to blow up a police transport, which can be perceived as a more legitimate target. But even the police transport maybe isn't a legitimate target if you haven't warned people, if you haven't tried. You know, as Data says, how did Data put it? I have it written down here. You know, terrorism may be acceptable if all other options for peaceful settlement had been foreclosed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you have to build up to it, just like we did in the American Revolutionary War. The other big difference about Washington, different than a quote-unquote terrorist, many times in the history of the world, you've had groups band together under a general. They fight off the oppressor, and what typically happens afterwards is that general becomes a dictator, he turns around and says, "Yay, we fought off the oppressor. Now I'm in charge."
Mm.
And he becomes the new leader of the government. Where Washington, after the Revolutionary War ended, he resigned. He stepped down. He's like, "I am not going to be part of the new government." For how long was it after the Revolutionary War before George Washington became president? I think it was like 8 years in there, right? Before we had a constitution where we were just the Confederates, we were under the Articles of Confederation, right? We were the Confederate States of America. We weren't the United States yet.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a time period where Washington said, "I fought the war, we won, other people will become the government." That was practically unprecedented in human history, that he was really fighting for the right to independence, but not to have him in charge. It took great pleading for him to even accept the nomination to become president once we had the Constitution.
Mm.
And even then, he served for 2 terms, and then he stepped down again. He's like, "That is enough. I can't serve for longer than this. It's too much. You need to have other people," which again, unheard of. So, I mean, there's some differences between Washington and a typical revolutionary general. But does Finn meet those qualities? We're not really sure. We're not given that much detail. I think the episode does really good about bringing up these questions, but doesn't answer them.
Yeah. All right. We better go on. But last thing on the terrorist thing, when she says, you know, you're just a terrorist. You're killing innocent people. I like his comeback. You know, how many innocent lives have been lost for freedom in the Federation, Doctor? And can't argue that point. So.
I mean, you can argue. You absolutely can argue this because there's not a. I don't think that there's kind of like a moral equivalence between, you know, what someone has done in the past and potentially the mistakes they've made to mean that it's okay to continue to, you know, make those mistakes going forward. Because, you know, otherwise, all you'd end up doing, right? You'd end up finding. Let's not necessarily consider this in Star Trek terms, but in terms of like states, mm-hmm. all you'd end up doing is you'd say, well, you know, in the entire history of, you know, the UK, we've killed less people than, say, France. So until the point where we overtake you, we're not going to take any lectures on how to conduct ourselves. So I think it's actually a bit of a cheap get out of jail clause here. Now, I do see where that's coming from in terms of that, you know, you have to always judge on an appropriate prism for the society at the time. So you can't necessarily expect them to be in the situation where the Federation are now. But if you just reduce everything down to where you've killed more people than us, I don't think that means you don't listen to their wisdom.
Yeah, if he was going to bring up Washington, I'm surprised he hasn't brought up Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I mean, you know, we wiped out how many people on one bomb drop or 2 bomb drops. So that might have been an interesting argument to come up with.
I think that probably was the subtle allusion that he was using when he challenged her how many innocent lives have been lost to for Federation freedom. Because, of course, the Federation is an allegory for the United States in real life.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go. Do you guys think the security director seemed a little on edge? I mean, every time that woman talked, her emotions were just front and center, and her she just seemed very edgy to me.
Well, I mean, she had 3 assassination attempts on her life. All her previous people were assassinated. You know, it's a tough job. I actually thought she did a pretty good job about keeping herself reserved. You know, I thought she was. She talks about how, you know, previous people in her position would just have people, you know, killed, disappeared in prison. And she stopped that. You know. Again, that's from her perspective. You know, how above board is she really? I'm not sure.
I mean, I did actually, I like this character. I thought this character was well written, and I think you can see the conflict that this particular one had. I do have to say, by the way, in terms of, like, if you want to throw the overlay of like Northern Ireland onto this, you probably would have had the UK government at the time claiming that the treatment that people were getting, you know, even terrorist sympathizers in, you know, in Northern Ireland, would have been better in the 90s than it would have been in the 70s. And I think that there's a, you know, some of the words and some of the kind of the moderating language that he uses would have had probably particular resonance for kind of English viewers or UK viewers.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, since the terrorists believe the Enterprise is involved, they decide to do a preemptive strike against the Enterprise by planting a bomb on the warp drive. I think they killed, what, three people on the ship?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
By the way, I love the way that there were the two people walking and then the red shirt got hit and then the blue shirt ran away.
Yeah!
it like made me chuckle.
Yeah, that was funny, yeah. Ah, ran off. So, but Worf gets shot in the leg. Go ahead.
I have to say, I actually like this action scene. I think this action scene is nicely paced, well done. You know, the right time, it stretched, you know, they try to achieve, you know, objective one and then they have to change it. There's a fair amount of action. I think the effect of the, you know, of the dimensional transporter or whatever you want to call it is particularly aggressive. So it kind of comes in a very sharp manner in keeping with them kind of being raided. I actually quite like this, you know, this set where they end up taking Picard is, I think, is a pretty good action scene.
Yeah. Because now they know the Federation's going to be involved. Maybe a doctor ain't enough, but boy, the Federation flagship captain, that'll get him involved. But Geordi was able to get the bomb off the main chamber and beam it off the ship in the nick of time, as always. That Geordi, he's resourceful. Okay, so the Wonder Kid, Wesley, reports that next time these people use that jump, we're going to be able to lock on to them. And they do. They lock on to him. So, but Finn transports aboard the ship and almost jumps Deanna, but unfortunately he did not shoot her. Even a good stunning would have been nice, but no. He wants a trade embargo and trade sanctions levied against Rutia, and they also demand the Federation to blockade the planet. No ships will be allowed to go in and out, and this will continue until they're government gives in to their demands, and phew, he's gone again. And this time, like I said, Wesley gets him.
So, when Finn pops into the hallway, is he just talking to a random crew member walking by? I mean, it happens to be Troy. I don't know how... Would they seem to have a lot of control over this inverter, and where do they go?
Sure.
I don't know if he was choosing to talk to Troy. He didn't have any reason to believe... He didn't know Troy.
No, I
think he just is just random person in the hallway. What if it's some Ensign? They're like, I don't remember exactly what he said.
Yeah, Ensign Ricky. Yeah, sir. Well, because Ensign Ricky'd have to report to Lieutenant Jones, which would have to report to Lieutenant Commander Smith, who then has to go up the, you know, rank to the commander of something, and eventually it would have cycled through to Riker. But unfortunately, the ship would have been destroyed by then. But yeah, you're right. So,
well, they probably have, you know, recordings of everything happening in all the hallways or whatever. You would think.
Just not the rumors. It would be.
Hopefully not. The computer's listening to you all the time.
Yeah.
Even in the bathroom.
But Admiral Giroc gets away with his Philotosin chip. And the obvious, look up here, nothing there. Look up there, nothing there. Oh, I can't believe I got away with this.
Did you have something else, James?
All I was going to say is that it was good that they didn't, like, you know, run into, you know, Ensign, you know, exaggerating Steve or whatever. So what did he say, Steve? Oh, he said this. Are you sure? We've had issues before, Steve. You weren't drinking, were you?
Yeah, too much synthahol, didn't you? Where were you coming from? Wait a minute. Weren't you supposed to be on duty at your workstation? So what if you find the guy who's ditching work and he can't tell anybody what happened? Because if he did, then they would know he wasn't at his workstation. But anyway, it seems like Finn's using fear to get Beverly to just cooperate with it. I may have to kill him. I may have to destroy the ship. I may have to destroy... Oh, goodness, I got to destroy your son. Oh, goodness, no. They're the ones killing your son, Doctor, not me. It was them.
He also seems to be legitimately sorry.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I'm sorry, the kid's on the ship. He's making what he perceives as, strategic decisions. And I don't know. I mean, we have this impression that, maybe he doesn't like having to kill anybody, or at least not as many people as he does, but I don't know. He is still making the decision, and it does seem, it seems to be over the line, right? Mm-hmm. This is the one place where we could say, yeah, that's pretty over the line. All the Federation did was provide medical supplies and food, and you're going to kill them? All right, that's too far, right?
Right.
This is the place where we can really say, well, it's pretty clear that that's not proportional response. So maybe you are a terrorist. Hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to go back a little bit. We sort of skipped over the whole subplot of just the inverters, mm-hmm. the transporter. So Picard assigns Wesley to do that, maybe just to keep him busy, right? but then there's that scene where Wesley remembers Elway's theorem and remembers this, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Wesley brings it up. And Data knew about it, and he explains it all once Wesley brings it up. But I don't know about that scene where if you're a scientist or an engineer, as Data is, right, and you're investigating something, I would think he's back there going, well, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this. We've had this with the ship's computer sometimes too. Why does it not make these obvious connections? Why do they need a human to say? And because Data's like, wait a minute, that was proven to be harmful to human flesh. They wouldn't do that. Come on, Data. Mm. That's why you eliminate it and didn't even bring it up until Wesley brought it up. It seems a bit childish, for Data. So that was like Wesley's shining moment, right? Where supposedly he remembered something that Wesley or that Data had, well, not that he hadn't remembered it, but he had ignored it.
Oh. Okay.
Data seems to have a real hard time imagining people doing bad things. I wonder how Data would react if he was put in a situation where he had to do something that was quote unquote bad. I guess we'll find out in The Most Toys. that's what that episode's all about. But
oh yeah, that's a good point. Data's never killed anybody, huh? Or he couldn't. He's not programmed to do that. Must have been a malfunction.
This whole thing about the inverter—it's very much like if we develop transporters nowadays, right? In the Star Trek universe, transporters already existed. But it's basically, so they had to just up at another level and say it was a transporter that left no trace. Mm. Except that it does, you just have to have the right equipment. It's almost, like in today's world, if somebody did develop transporters, it would suddenly be a huge deal, like this is. So I can see a lot of parallels there. This is a typical issue with Star Trek writing, right? They bring up this technology that is, basically never seen again. Every time they bring up different methods of transporting like this, this transporter actually is very much like the folded space transporter that's seen in the Voyager episode Prime Factors. Mm-hmm. The concept that this transporter is no good just because it hurts living flesh, that doesn't make any sense, right?
doesn't.
I mean, you can't transport people with it, but you could. The Rutians could be transporting all kinds of material supplies or bombs or this. Any transporter is an effective military weapon. You don't need to transport people in order for it to be important. So, again, why did Data not pick up on that? But the writers, too. I mean, they occasionally invent these technologies that are really quite powerful. You know, if you're in a battle with a Romulan and you can't transport through their shields, but you can use a subspace inverter to transport a bomb in there. Yet we never see this technology again.
Of course, there's a lot of technology we'll never see again. One and out.
No, I think there was a debate a little while back. I can't remember where I heard it, but they basically said if you could actually transport a bomb onto the other ship and just transport the photon torpedo over, it would be the most effective weapon that you can imagine. It would just be a single hit, and then that's it. Can I bring up one slight thing about the inverter? And that is that the way that they take out the Enterprise and how quickly and how effectively they manage to do it, it makes me wonder why they haven't managed to achieve more. Because it sounds like, they've planted a couple of bombs, they've hit a bus full of policemen that they thought it was going to be full of policemen in any case. But if you the mechanism that they actually use this tech to get onto the Enterprise and to take hostages, you would imagine, and also given the number of people that are around, you would imagine that they could have just gone after, the head of state or the head of government or the head of military or whoever the bad guy is that's oppressing them, and basically just taking them out very clinically in one go. And then when the next guy comes around with the same thing, they could have done it again. And then they could have done it again. And I can probably think that after like the fifth or sixth guy, you would probably get enough attention for this to be escalated up the, up the things to solve on the planet this week. And it seemed that it was a bit strange that they didn't seem to take advantage of the technology as well as I would have imagined they could have done.
That's a good point. We see that Finn's skills are lacking, right? I mean, you're right. He could have chosen legitimate targets, high-ranking police officer or high-ranking politicians. He could have even warned them ahead of time. There's no way that they could stop it. He's like, I warn you, you need to come to the table and negotiate with us for our independence or we're going to take you out. And yet they don't. Instead, he gets involved with an innocent bystander like the Federation. So, yeah, that's a good point. I was sort of surprised that there was a point in the episode where they said there were only about 200 Ansada terrorists. It just doesn't seem like a lot. I don't know how big this land is. Like, maybe that's just in the city? I don't know.
There may be a lot more than their sympathizers, and that's just what the government believes they have.
Well, the government, she also talked about 5,000 sympathizers,
So any day, but those could turn to terrorists.
Yeah. The fact that the government is tracking people close enough to know that they're sympathizers, that sort of makes you think, well, maybe there's something wrong with the government. But also, I mean, the fact that such a small number of people are really part of this core rebellion makes you think, well, maybe they don't really have a good cause to begin with. Plus, they're making some pretty bad decisions, as James pointed out.
I mean, I was about to say, I think even the number 5,000, right, isn't that larger people. That's just not that many people. So if we're to believe that this is a world, but I think what often happens in Trek is that when we say world, we don't mean world. We mean, small nation. And sometimes we don't even mean small nation. We mean like city state. And we kind of, we always reduce it down to that level because, frankly, it's very hard for them to project stories otherwise. But one thing that is probably worth noting is that most states that are fighting terrorists or most states are in this position, certainly by the time we've got into kind of clampdowns and heightened awareness and people being assassinated, the state's natural position would be to overestimate support anyway, which is why the number of 5,000 seems like extremely low. You would have imagined they would be seeing shadows everywhere and would imagine that 10% of the population were sympathizers. So that was something that didn't quite sit right with me.
Okay. Well, that pretty much brings us to almost the end, where the Rutians do they use their own technology, or do they just use the transporter technology when they find out where they are, just to beam them in and take over the compound?
I think they have to use the Enterprise transporters. I don't think the Rutians have transporters. And the Separatist outpost had no tunnel entrances. They'd all been sealed off.
Mm. Okay.
This is what we talked about earlier with Riker really should not have involved the police in that part of the rescue.
Right. Okay, and just about as Finn is about ready to shoot Picard, that's when the security director shoots him in the back. And it's interesting that they say, did you have to kill him? I kind of agree with her way of thinking. If we are on their side, unfortunately, if he was in prison, his followers would have built up forces to free him, but now he's a martyr.
But I don't know. Like Finn says, maybe a martyr's worth more than a leader. Mm-hmm. It's all about the ideas. If you can, if you have a good martyr, one who's clearly believes in the ideals, and the ideals, are good and right, that can really motivate a lot more people to shift from sympathizers to full on separatist.
Okay.
I have to agree. I think that from the planet's perspective, it probably suits them in the short term to have him dead, but I think in the long term, probably not. Having said that, I thought that it was a bit rich of Riker to question the decision that was being made effectively on the battlefield. I personally think that it was, the call that was taken is something that would have needed to be discussed in terms of rules of engagement before you went down there. And then lacking that, I don't think the correct place to have the philosophical discussion about whether you execute the guy is whilst you're effectively still overrunning the compound and you probably haven't secured it. Oh. We missed out, by the way, the big discussion between between Picard and Crusher about when Crusher effectively starts mentioning and the things that she's kind of learned and questioning whether or not there's as much black and white in the Federation's position. I thought that in general that was a bit too thickly laid on, and I didn't think it was as well discussed as it could have been. I think it was a little simplistic. In particular, I think Picard was relatively well written. I thought that the Crusher kind of turned it a little too quick.
Oh yes,
especially given the Wesley situation, which to me, I don't think anyone in that position would be coming back and saying, oh no, they do have they potentially do have just cause. We gave their enemy food. Really, to take out a ship with I don't know how old Wesley is now, 14, 15 or so. I don't think it's quite there's no equivalence of conscience there, right? If you give someone food versus they come around and kill your son.
Wesley's 17.
He doesn't look a day over. Really?
He is. In late first season, he said he was 15, but turning 16 in a couple weeks or something.
Oh, that's right. So you don't look old enough to apply for the Academy.
This is early third season, so he'd be 17.
All right. So.
Wow.
Whatever.
All right. So just about the end of the raid. You know, everybody's in custody, but yet one boy is able to come back with a rifle and points it toward the director, and she's probably thinking, oh, here we go. But Riker's able to talk him off the ledge, and observes that, you know, he could have killed you, but he didn't, so maybe the end's beginning.
Is it Riker, really?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was Crusher.
No, I thought it was, you know, I mean, Riker says, you know, maybe the end begins with one boy putting down his weapon.
Yeah, that, yes. But I'm just saying, when the boy's about to shoot, it's Crusher who looks at him, you know, Dr. Beverly Crusher, you know, looks at him and says something, or maybe it's just a look. I thought it was, they were trying to say the boy knew her and understood her, respected her a little bit as a doctor or as a person. That, again, maybe I'm reading things into it because this is what I want to be true, right? That when people make connections, when you actually learn about your supposed enemy and you learn to treat them as people and not as the nemesis, then the violence stops. You know, you're able to forgive. I don't know.
Could I ask a controversial question here? Mm-hmm. And that is, should he not have shot the woman? Should it not happen? Isn't the main kind of theme of this episode that the violence should have continued in this case?
No, I don't. I think he probably saw what was happening, and maybe he doesn't quite believe that his whole life is just to be a terrorist. Maybe he wants to be something different.
I mean, I think that's a pretty large kind of, you know, Road to Damascus moment to place on a, again, now I'm going to misjudge his age, an 11-year-old, I think. Mm-hmm. Certainly someone that's been kind of embedded in this culture for so long. The episode, kind of the ending and the twist, kind of slightly reminds me of, you know, there's a great DS9 episode in season one, which is Duet, and right at the end of Duet, spoilers, despite everyone coming round, you know, the violence still continues in pretty much in the final act of that episode. And I think that that's a much more powerful statement that gets made, because it allows, first of all, because it prevents the entire thing being kind of very nicely tied up and shining a bright light as we warp off. But it also allows the character, in this case it's Kira, to really learn and to then question her own side. And I kind of thought that, you know, what comeuppance does the major government have against the separatists or the terrorists here? They don't get any. So all they're going to do is they're going to have learned that, you know, with a little bit more oppression and a little bit more kind of, you know, better luck of taking out these terrorists, they'll be all fine. And then eventually they're going to stop and go home. And I didn't think that that's where the story was trying to push its message.
Mm. All right, then. Well, do we have anything else to bring up? Something we missed?
A couple little things. During the raid, there was another example of that time they used, like, the Vulcan nerve pinch in a box. Did you guys notice that?
They use a Vulcan nerve pinch?
It's not an actual Vulcan nerve pinch, but there's a couple times in Star Trek when they go and do raids, they'll be carrying some kind of small little device in their hands that they'll use on people's necks to knock them out.
Oh, yes.
It happened in this episode.
Yeah.
Occasionally I see that, and I'm like, you know, why don't they use that more often? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead of a phaser on stun, I guess, would have done just as well. But the other little observation I made about this episode is it feels so much like the fourth season episode, Legacy. Just, you know, you had two groups fighting. A lot of the production values are the same. And you had the tall blonde woman who was from the planet and representing one side or the other, right? Ishar Yar in that later episode.
Yeah.
It's just so similar in texture, if not the actual story. And they were going in to rescue people in that. Anyway,
well, just,
it's just a...
Just wait till we accidentally stumble on the Data goes crazy and tries to take over the ship plot. That gets reused a few times. just in different ways. Okay.
You notice how there's a moment where Crusher, where Finn's about to kill Picard right before he gets killed. And Crusher is pleading with Finn to not kill Picard. I mean, obviously, I think anyone would. Well, number one, why didn't she just throw something at him? Or why didn't she attack him? Right? She's a Starfleet officer. I think that's, you know, 90s television writing.
No, she's too far away. She's too far away, and...
She doesn't have a weapon, like the police officer that shows up. But anyway, it's just that one of those few moments in the show where we're reminded about how much Beverly cares about John Luke. You know, you get little hints of it throughout the series.
Yeah, of course. She's just not asking for child support from him.
Okay, can I go off on a really creepy tangent here? Because it just reminded me of something when you were mentioning Crusher and Picard, which is that the dude that has them, you know, hostage, ends up producing this portfolio.
Yeah.
Of Crusher's most erotic features, and I kind of found that really quite creepy. And you know, you obviously realize that the guy's become infatuated with Crusher, and then when she kind of hands it over to Picard, Picard's sitting there thinking, well, at least in my mind, I read it as he's thinking, "Ooh, so if nothing else, you'll be able to distract him for around 30 or 40 minutes, right?" As he plans his escape. Am I alone in reading that Picard basically wanted her to go in a quote, keep him busy, unquote?
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
No, because I mean, he says, you know, yeah, looks like you've gained his, I don't know about trust, but, you know, and maybe some more. We could use this to our advantage. So who knows? Maybe he did want to pimp her out. That's a good one, James, because I forgot about the portrait.
If nothing else, like, there's an emotional connection.
Yeah. Yeah, usually, you know, the Stockholm Syndrome, isn't that what it is? But usually it's the other way around, where she starts to align herself with her captors, but yet he's the one that was falling for her, it seems. She seemed to be falling for the romanticism of what they're doing. He seemed to be falling for her. Make sense? Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, I can take that.
Okay. All right, then. Data, anything? You got one last shot.
All right, let's talk about there was one point where Finn and Beverly were talking to each other, and Beverly said something about political power does not flow from the barrel of a gun. Was that her, or was it the police officer? I don't know who said it, but somebody in this episode
I thought it was Picard.
Okay. Maybe it was Picard. Anyway, just that phrase, political power flowing from the barrel of a gun. I think political power does flow from the barrel of a gun. All governments that exist because they have power.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's not a question of whether or not power is part of politics. The question is, who's controlling the gunpowder, right? It's about the fairness of control of that force and not the fact that it exists. Of course it exists. That's the whole point of politics, is to control your power. So, I don't know.
Whoever has the best shot, I guess, is the one who wins. Okay, then. Well, then, yeah, we are... Wow, over an hour and a half, James, on this 35-minute episode, huh?
We're doing well.
I keep messing with them on that one. Okay, then I guess it's now time to take us into our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the defector. Nah, it's not the defector, but... Okay, whether you believe in the cause or not, you gotta admit sometimes it is effective. And it seems this week the Federation actually took a side, like I said, unlike last week when they stepped aside. It seems they aligned themselves with the Rutians and helped bring the Ansadis terrorists down. The planet isn't even a member of the Federation. We just trade with them, and we find ourselves in the middle of their conflict. Whether I agree with Picard's decisions... I'm sorry. where I agreed with Picard's decision last week to refuse to interfere when the Angosians were abusing their own veterans, forcing them to retaliate against the state. This week I kind of reject his systematic shutdown of the Ansada simply because two Federation officers were hostages, and I guess he really didn't do it. At that point, he was a hostage. It was up to Riker, and he decided to assist the Rutians. Let's see. You know, where is the notion of Federation officers willing to give their lives for the Prime Directive? So, I guess Picard should have, you know, been willing to die for his cause. Or we're not even sure what Picard's real stance on this whole thing was, in a sense. Except for the arguments he was given to both Crusher and Data. I have in my notes, I'm not even sure if Rutia is a warp-capable planet yet, so really, why? How involved should we be? In the end, I do kind of disagree with Picard and taking a side, but I still think the episode's pretty good, so, you know, in a sense, I'm going to still give this one a 4 out of 5. Data, what about you?
Yeah, so I really quite like this episode. I think it does what good Trek does. It brings up a lot of good, interesting moral questions. I think, personally, I believe history shows that the only effective way to deal with terrorism is to talk, to negotiate with terrorists. You have to negotiate with terrorists, no matter how much politicians want to say that we don't negotiate with terrorists. The only way to actually resolve problems is to communicate. And I think this show is trying to show that. I think maybe the writers, because truthfully, I didn't really notice it either until we talked about it on this podcast. The writers like accidentally presented this case where Riker made a bad call and sided too strongly with one side over the other. But that also brings up an issue which we get in some episodes, especially in Deep Space Nine, which is tends to be a darker show, obviously, for that reason. There are times when the Federation has this strength of moral cowardice. You know, where they ignored the Bajoran problem because they, had a treaty with the Cardassians? You know, and here they're helping the Rutians.
Right, we were innocent bystanders.
Yeah, I mean, well, in this situation, we're innocent bystanders too, and yet we make a choice to help the Rutians defeat the Ansada without really understanding all the players. I don't know. It seems, ultimately, in real life, right? You cannot fix everybody's problems. You just don't have the power. But often in Star Trek, we're given the impression that, well, the Federation does have all the power. They, you know, they can replicate whatever they want. Or, you know, those. I mean, I have to imagine that in real, quote unquote, real Star Trek universe life, there really are limits to how much they can do. I mean, they cannot fight their way into the Bajoran space and kick out the Cardassians just because the Cardassians are treating Bajorans poorly. You know, these are real life issues that are often glazed over on Trek. And this episode, I think, does a bit of a glazed job. It brings up a lot of good questions, but ignores some of the more fundamental ones that really get to the heart of, hey, your Federation isn't perfect either. But anyway, I enjoy the episode. I also think it's a 4 out of 5.
Okay. Doctor?
Well, I think I'm clearly out of step with everyone here because I was coming into this thinking it's like a 2 out of 5 kind of show. Because I didn't... Okay, by the way, I have like warmed to it as we have discussed, and I think that's kind of what we often do, right? Let me just say, I think from a technical perspective, this is a... On paper, at least, it looks like a good episode. I like Trek when it tries to do these like messages shows. They try to parallel something in reality into the Star Trek universe, and they have various comments on it. I also like the tech. I like both the tech of the dimensional rift thing. That is interesting. I think that the action scenes are also good. It's a quite well crafted, episode. And actually, something that we haven't really had a huge amount to say. I think Gaith McFadden does well in this episode. I think she, what she's asked to do whilst being abducted and stuff. Although I don't necessarily agree with her and how quickly she comes around to, the viewpoint, but I think how forcefully she expresses the viewpoint at the end of the episode to Picard. Leaving that aside, I actually think that technically it's a good performance on her side. I do think it's very simplistic. I think it's very difficult for me not to see. I think are pretty clear kind of strokes on the commentary on the Iron Island situation, which I think is simplistic, or at least it's simplistically portrayed. But I haven't. I've certainly very much enjoyed our discussion on it. I had not noticed the issue of Riker effectively making mistakes within the episode. I don't know whether that's something that the writers themselves didn't even realize they were doing, but I think it's completely legitimate that that they possibly could have had that called out, because it's one of these things. I don't think the viewer notices it. You generally need a character in the other person's camp so you can see what they're doing and give them, understand their motivation. And I think that it's only late. Had they called out the influence we were giving them, certainly in terms of leading them to the rebel base and allowing the person to shoot down the other leader, I think that's certainly a completely valid criticism of the Federation involvement. Anyway, I'll stop talking now. I'll hand it a 3 out of 5. I think it's fine in the end. I think it's I've really enjoyed the discussion, and I think that it's not the best episode in the world, certainly, but let me put it in the middle of the road.
Okay, great. And in the time that we have been talking about this, I actually was able to install Microsoft Office, and so now I have the guest list back up. So, Data, looks like we're having you on again for The Offspring sometime around the middle of October.
Yeah, I think. About 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Well, it's good to have you on again, so I guess we will talk to you for the Offspring, which is an interesting one, and this is directed by Jonathan Frakes, right? I believe.
Yes. That was his first directing gig, I believe, right?
Yes, and he obviously hits on an android without even knowing it. Amazing. You're new around here.
The Offspring isn't an interesting episode. It's a perfect episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that without any fear of contradiction in just over a month.
I believe so, too. Yes, I believe so, too.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation, the evil-minded Q is back and desperate.
What is it you want, Q?
Sanctuary on this ship.
His powers have been destroyed.
Help me!
Leaving him a mere mortal.
Just one of the boys, eh?
No, alien forces are out for the kill, and only the Enterprise stands in their way. One Star Trek for the Next Generation.
Okay, then. All right, Data, again, thank you. We will see you again. So join us next week, everyone else, including Data. You're free to listen in as we review episode 13 of season 3, and this is called Deja Q. And at this time we have Ben slated to come on, and then after that we have A Matter of Perspective with Carnivore J. So once again, thank you, Data, and everyone, thank you for downloading, and good night.
Okay, good night, everyone.
Joel Antru. Deep door his musma.
All right, and now it's time to go into some forum feedback. This time we're going to start with, this one's The Price. And this time we start with Ben, Captain Proton.
Captain Protonix,
who should be on next week, I would hope. He says, I will have to agree with Lou, this episode is quite dull. Keep that in mind, guys. He says this episode is quite dull. We're going to be calling back to that. The only time I've watched it before this podcast was when I wanted to watch False Prophets. Back to back, the episodes are entertaining, but only because it is fun to have some continuity in life. And Ferengi Rock, 5 stars. So he's right. You know, this episode was quite dull, but yet 5 stars. Only in Ben's world could that happen. Let me see where we were. Price. We both gave it a 2. So good job, Ben.
So we now go on to Kieran McDuff, who posts, the main plot of this episode is boring as sin. Really? It's truly awful. I love that start. I really do. And by the way, despite that, there's still at least 100, well, not 100, a couple of thousand words that come next. I really don't care about the negotiations for the wormhole. How do you get an entire episode A plot out of that? That's barely a B plot. The Troy and Devanani relationship at least puts an interesting spin on it. But I'm with James. It's really badly done. He's basically a sales guy, and we all know sales guys need a certain personality to be good at their job, and Devanani is definitely that kind of personality. Accepting that premise, how does Troy, a beta set woman who can sense emotion, fall for any of his sales guy chat? Yes, I know he's half betazoid, but since when did that block people from sensing anything? We know later that they're trained to block out the noise, but I've no recollection of ever being able to block out each other. In fact, Deanna usually complains when people do that, yet not this time. As such, he plays her like a fiddle. I really don't mind Troy's relationship stories for the most part. We'll moan about the Worf one eventually, but this one is truly grim. And do you know what is the worst part of this episode? The leotard scene. Sorry, Lou, but this was just awful. They clearly tried really hard to make Troy and Crusher. Sorry. They tried really hard to make Troy and Crusher. They clearly tried really hard to make Troy and Crusher bend it over a lot, a really sexy thing, and normally I'd agree. I'm a red-blooded male. I might prefer Dr. Crusher to Troy, but that's not to say I don't find Troy attractive as well. But those leotards were truly, yeah, utterly horrendous, and even I feel really creepy watching the whole thing.
This is staying, you know.
Dude, this should have been one of those seats where I loved in my life.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, yeah. I got... Okay, so somehow I'm expected now to read. This should have been one of those scenes I logged in my long-term memory as a teenager and recalled on those quite alone time moments. but it never was. And I can't. And so I can't even say this was me growing up that makes me creeped out watching it. Okay. really. Good. Honestly, give me the goddess of empathy any day. Hey, there's nothing wrong with the goddess of empathy at all. In fact, I'd even take naked now drunken Crusher hating on Picard over at this. The best bit of this episode was Baz and Wormhole itself. That was some really nice science, and clearly it's a useful way of travelling. I can understand people wanting to sell the operation of this wormhole, and obviously we know the Bajorans benefit from this same idea later on, and I even like the fact that it turns out to be a problem with the whole thing moving about at one end. I was never entirely convinced that it made it useless, though, as they didn't make it clear how unstable the jumping about was. In fact, Voyager suggested that it jumped to the same series of locations, and you could even record it to one of those locations, so it suggested it would still be of use. Incidentally, I really like the fact that they returned this storyline to Voyager. Of course, you brought up the complete lack of due diligence on the contract. I hadn't considered that aspect. But you're right that there must be some type of warranty period, or even a clause in the contract to say it's null and void after someone does some proper scientific research into the wormhole, since the Barzans couldn't. Their lack of expertise also feed into why they say that the stable end was only recently being discovered. Space is big, so it's always possible they didn't notice that it was there for long enough, just as the Bajoran wormhole. No one knew about the Bajoran wormhole until Sisko and Dask found it after all. They might also say why the Dominion didn't know about this wormhole, or the Bajoran one. They're hard enough to find without adding the fact that that their end of the Barzan wormhole moves about. As for them mentioning that the stable end appears, I didn't have much of a problem with that. I always understood it to mean that it was the event horizon that appeared, in the same way that the mouth of the wormhole appears and then disappears. The wormhole itself was stable and always there. I loved the discussion on the shuttle pod size. That's something else that I hadn't considered. It really wasn't practical at all, is it? It's amazingly cramped to the point of being almost utterly useless. All I can say is that I hope Geordi has a bag to pee in. Overall, this episode hasn't got much going for it, away from the wormhole science. It's truly insulting to Troy, it's boring in large parts, the music is rather odd, just throw things even further off excess. And it has the Ferengi, and I hate the Ferengi. Hi, Ben. I'm giving this one a disappointing 1 out of 5.
Okay.
Could you edit me so try. That I don't sound like a lunatic?
I can try.
We'll see.
Okay.
Time memories.
Really?
Really?
Okay. Let's see. But, you know, as far as the wormhole appearing, I guess what he's saying is that the Barzan wormhole probably is usable anytime you want it, just like the Bajoran wormhole, or because it seemed like, you know, they say, okay, it's going to appear shortly, almost like it was on a timetable. But maybe I misunderstood. Okay, Endicor comes on and says, seeing how much fun you had discussing this episode, I was surprised to hear your final ratings. While the main plot wasn't anything exciting, I thought I was simply the wrong... Uh-oh, wait a second, hold on. We may get some information out of this one. While the main plot wasn't exciting, I thought I was simply the wrong gender to appreciate the relationship from Troy's perspective. All right, guy. Yes, he says, yes, I am a guy, so I need to refer me with both sets of gender pronouns. All right, we got one mystery solved about Endicor, don't we? So, that story's conclusion was definitely the weak point of the episode, as Troy's revelation of Rawl's secret was really underwhelming and didn't change anyone's mind of the situation at all. Still, watching Rawl up to that point was fun because it played pitch perfect as a smooth-talking guy you just love to hate. The Barzan wormhole was fantastic universe building. This episode established the galaxy being divided into 4 quadrants and sets up the uniqueness of the Bajoran wormhole. The premise of a less advanced civilization auctioning the wormhole was also an interesting idea. As someone who normally hates Ferengi episodes, I was quite surprised how much I enjoyed every scene they were in. This episode caught the concept of the Ferengi just at the right moment of transition from the failed Klingon replacements of Season 1 to the annoying buffoons of later Trek. It's fun and satisfying to watch their plans fail precisely because they are characterized as ignorant and overconfident, rather than a non-menace or a dim-witted klutzes. This episode may in fact be the best appearance of the Ferengi in TNG, and you should be recognized for it. Do you agree?
Actually, I was just going to jump in on that. I think this is a very valid point. Actually, I think it is a point. I'm trying to think about... Okay, we're going to come up to Menage a Troi a little bit. And I think Menage a Troi, I can't remember the Ferengi being particularly bad in that. So maybe they are good as well. But I do agree that you get this... you know, you've got a certain... You certainly have had a certain evolution of the underlying species. And by the time you do hit the S9, you have, okay, you're looking at a different type of Ferengi. Of course, you're looking at the businessman rather than the military. And, you know, I don't think those two things are necessarily in conflict with each other. I think that the Ferengi Alliance could still have the military, and the military could behave in the way that is shown in this episode. I do like where they go with the S9 with the Ferengi. But thinking about the times that we come across the military Ferengi, I'm struggling not to agree that this is the better, you know, best appearance. Because it's in Captain's Holiday, right? When, you know, Picard punches the Ferengi. I think it's, you know, it's, yeah, Max Credenti.
Silvora or something like that. Credenti
becomes Rom. And he, yeah, and doesn't he, like, knock him out by throwing the phaser from one hand to the other and then punching him as the Ferengi looks on, like, puzzled? And I do think that kind of stuff is a little bit overdone in later, you know, in later seasons. I'm also thinking about Rascals in the Ferengi in Rascals, and I think they're not, you know, I do think that dim-witted klutzes is probably what you would describe them as.
Yeah, they got a pretty good achievement in military strategy by taking over the flagship of the Federation, but then the klutzness comes out. So this episode, I think, is really the, I guess, when DS9 writers went back to Ferengi and say, how do we want to gauge Quark and the rest of the Ferengi, they probably picked this one as over-profiting. And yeah, I think it's, for what the Ferengi become, this is the best one for TNG. Okay, all right. So he finishes by saying, also, nothing beats pointing to this episode's leotard scene to stop prudish nerds from whining about Abrams' Trek being overly sexualized when it was this way from the beginning of TNG. I'd wager that Marina Sirtis wasn't wearing those low-cut dresses because she liked them. For all the above reasons, this episode deserves a 3 out of 5. So, Ben, you're way up there on your own ratings. No one's agreeing. Okay, we got one more from Blair.
Again, yeah, finally from Blair, I think he's going to be joining us as well relatively soon, I think. I seem to recall on the schedule. Okay, so, hi, guys. It's been a while. I'm in the process of catching up on the Battlebred podcast. So, good. I agree with the posts above. I attribute my lack of interest in this episode on the emphasis on Troy's relationship. For me, she isn't one of my favourite characters. Add a love story on top of that, and you've lost me. The Ferengi weren't bad this week, however. I loved your shuttle pod and contract discussion. Overall, a fun podcast for a dull episode. As a fan of continuity, I love how Voyager calls back to this episode years later. It makes watching this episode a little bit more bearable. For that reason, I'll rate this a 2.25. Now, when are you going to post your photos of you guys doing your pre-Battle Bridge workouts in leotards? I mean, Lou, do you take them down before Blair can find them? I mean, I don't quite understand the question.
Oh, he's trying to get us in leotards to show what, you know, our pre-Battle Bridge workout. In other words, we get into our leotards and we exercise before we do the show. And the only thing I could say is that picture of me in leotards would go viral, but for very much the wrong reasons, to the point where I don't think I could ever walk out of the house again, because people will know that's the leotard man. That's the fat leotard man. So, no, I don't. No. Not even on my best, drunkest of Halloween costumes could that ever happen. But I don't know about you, Doc. But you're a lot smaller than I am, and yeah, you're better looking than I am. So maybe the leotards have fit you good. I don't know.
I do not have a leotard.
Not me either. I don't think they make them big enough. Well, no, they probably do, but I'll go with I don't think they make them big enough. And as far as Blair coming on, we don't have Blair until the end of the season with the Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and 2. So unless I've screwed up again on scheduling, I don't have them anywhere.
No, it's probably my mistake. Although, hey, that's a fine episode to come on for.
Oh, hell yeah. Absolutely. So, Okay, then. Thank you guys for your review, and hopefully, you know, let's keep it up. We had four here, and, you know, I hate to sound jealous. I really would like some more feedback, and we get, you know, quite a few downloads, a lot more than four. So, you know, please come into the TrekMateFamily.com and look for the forums and become a forum member and leave us your review. And as you see, we've been giving Endicor a lot of praise the last 4 weeks for joining us and sticking with us so far. And you could too. We'd love to have you. So please join us for the forums. It helps TrekMate out. All right. So thank you again and good night. Sweet prince. Oh, and I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. Yes, I did. You're so handsome.